now.
I don't know who he is behind that mask of his, but I do know when we need him. And we need him now.
I'll call him, sir.
For some reason, the cool bars in Hollywood have to be hard to find and have no sign.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
We are talking about the show Mannix on this edition of The Cocktail Nation with the author of the new book on this wonderful TV show. I've got a cool way to give your kitchen that retro feel in your pad, and we find out what's been happening with that 1957 Plymouth that was buried in the ground in Tulsa and exhumed in 2007. We'll see how that one panned out. News on the 64 World's Fair and what they got right in their predictions. Plus, I've got loads of swank events from across the globe to check out. Right now, some new music from Exotic Agogo and Big Bossa Man on The Cocktail Nation.
The Cocktail Nation.
Thanks to Ultraswank.net.
Thank you.
Cocktail Nation with Tiki Lounge Crew and Bikini Bambi. Do check out my website, www.cocktailnation.net. Loads of great stuff on there. We've got the Swank Advice column, the World of Swank Gig Guide, and, of course, news from across the globe, various news that we find, retro news that we post up there for you, and lots of other fun things, along with some pictures of moi. So do check it out, cocktailnation.net. Joanne Paul joins me, and now back to Mannix. And I was so pleased to find somebody's written a book about this TV show. It was a TV show that I grew up with, and more recently got to know it again because I found there was a stack of DVDs out on the TV series, which is these days a real blessing that we've got, you know, so many things being re-released through DVD that, you know, things that you grew up with you can once again enjoy.
Yeah, they're beautiful quality too. I that series is really lucky in that regard. The series is it's restored, and I mean, they have nice menus and everything else that other series don't have. Mannix was also heavily cut in syndication, so that you can really see it better on these DVDs now than you ever could.
What made you decide to write a book about Mannix?
That part is actually strange, because it sort of happened to me more than I decided anything. In January of 2011, the DVDs for season 4 arrived on my doorstep, and I started to watch them. And I loved the series as a kid, and I just never thought that I would, you know, love it 40 years later the way that I did. But I connected with it, and I realized, gee, you know, this character's really been with me all along. He's just had some of these great properties of individualism and toughness and vulnerability, and I started to write about it on a site called Mannix is Coming on the Home Theater Forum. And just by writing there, I started to write things about the series and things about heroes, and it went from there.
Isn't that amazing? I love how in your bio it says your childhood hero was shot, drugged, poisoned, beaten, tortured, dumped down hillsides to be left for dead. Nothing could have prepared you for a better life. which is the way that you've taken a look at this book as well. It's not just a book of dates and characters and whatnot. You've sort of gone a little bit further than this.
Right. I don't even think that Mike Connors wanted a book like that. When I talk with him, he didn't want a behind the scenes book. He was really into the qualities of character, and that's really what I connected with. So that's what I ended up writing about. I mean, it's like I said, it's more evolved. I mean, you can actually see the evolution of my thinking behind this if you look at that Mannix is Coming thread. That at first I just, you know, I hardly write anything at all, and then I start to think about it. I start to research the series. I really, a lot of the writing had to do with wanting to make sure that the rest of the series was released on DVD, because it had stalled between seasons 3 and 4, and I just wanted to make sure I saw the rest of it again. I saw it as a kid. It wasn't running in syndication. The 8th season was never seen in syndication anywhere in the world. So it was really just trying to get people to realize that the series was a lot better than a lot of people remember, and saying why, and I just kept writing and has never really stopped. I keep writing on that thread, even though the book is done.
Really? Star Mike Connors, I mean, he's a captivating character as Mannix. I mean, you just can't take your eyes off him. He's got that it thing that they often talk about with actors. What did he do after Mannix? I'm curious about that.
Well, he actually, he had a movie career prior to Mannix that it was sort of stalled, and I mean, he'll admit this, and you know, you could see it written in articles that, you know, it wasn't going anywhere. And he actually did Mannix, intending to do it only for a year or two before going back to his movie career. But once he became Joe Mannix, he became so identified with that character, I think it was hard for him to do anything else. The other thing about Mannix that I never realized before, I can't think of any other TV series, and if somebody can, please let me know, that was so much about a single character that lasted so long and had this mixture of emotional response and action associated with it. That series had to be tough to do. You know, I saw an interview of him on The Tonight Show after the series ended where he said he was, you know, tired and going to take a couple of years off. Another thing is that, he didn't tell me this, but I know he had some issues with his son, and I think that probably affected him.
Yeah, yeah. What a fabulous show in that it had a very, very good run compared to a lot of television series. 1967 to 75 is a pretty good run. And, of course, syndicated to 70-odd countries. This was a very, very successful TV show, wasn't it?
It was extremely successful. I remember in the day too. I mean, it was enormously popular. I never really it took me years to see it again. I never understood why Star Trek and Mission Impossible and other series, which I considered, they were okay, but I didn't consider them nearly as special. They've got cult followings at this point. Manix just sort of, it's almost disappeared. From syndication runs. Anyway, you have to buy the DVDs.
Yeah. And there's it's amazing when you watch these shows. I mean, the action that was in these shows was just incredible. Did Mike Connors do many of his own stunts, or did he employ a stunt guy? Because, he seemed like a pretty athletic sort of guy.
He was very athletic. He did a lot of them in the beginning of the series, and there's an article that talks about how towards maybe the fifth season or so, he started to tone down on a little bit. I can't imagine. I mean, imagine these days letting him do the stunts. You could see on the DVDs, you can freeze and see that they're his face, that he does many of them at the beginning. I can't even imagine the insurance that Paramount, it was Desilu at the very beginning, but that Paramount would have had on him to allow him to do that. But yeah, he did. He was, he played basketball in college. He was a very athletic guy. I think I read once where in the Army, because he was in World War II, he was actually... He trained people athletically. He was in some type of a position where, he was just a very athletic guy. Mm.
What did you learn about the book? What did you learn about the TV show that you didn't know particularly? I suppose talking to Mike Connors, imagine you would have picked up a few things. You think, wow, I had no idea.
Well, I think the biggest one was that when you watch that series, you have the impression, well, this is a hero, and you liked it as a kid, and. And there were certain things you liked about it that you wouldn't like it as an adult. But, I mean, a lot of the things that were particular to that character, he did on purpose. He actually put them in there that, for instance, his father was a lawyer that he actually, his father died when Mike Connors was about 18 years old. And he was this sort of character like the Atticus Finch character in To Kill a Mockingbird where he would, just take not necessarily money, but something in kind for doing work. You could see some of that in the character of Joe Mannix. I mean, he brought a certain reality to that character that was really intended and on purpose, and it was so much more about him than I expected.
Imagine meeting Mike Connors for the first time. Was it for the first time when you did this book?
I actually met him prior to deciding to write the book. Although, if I think about it in retrospect, I was probably thinking about doing one at the time, but not consciously.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I mean, I loved it. I loved that meeting. I'll never forget it.
Well, that's the thing, I suppose. When you're watching a TV show as a kid, you clearly identify with the show. You really enjoy the show. You started writing about the show. To meet the lead character, I mean, that just blows your mind, even as an adult, doesn't it?
And the funny thing is, yeah, I mean, he's an imposing individual. I mean, like you said, I like what you said, that he has this sort of it quality. Mm. It's really hard to put words into that. I mean, you could write a book about it. That's what does that even mean? He still has it. I mean, you meet this guy, and it's just sort of like it's a little bit intimidating. I mean, you could spend the rest of your life trying to understand that. You get a little bit closer to it, I think you get a little bit better.
Yeah. How does he feel about the TV show now? In several decades on, thinking back to it.
Oh, I think he's definitely proud of it. Obviously, that's his signature work. I have said to him on many occasions that I think it's been underrated, overlooked, and I know that he agrees with that, but he wouldn't come out and say that. I know that he doesn't completely understand necessarily why the show hasn't been maybe lauded and praised as much as some other shows, which, he wouldn't say this, but I consider to be of significantly lesser quality. I know that first run, it was a huge deal, and then some shows that necessarily were not as big a deal first run became more popular with the baby boomer generation, and I write some in the book about how I think that's actually a negative reflection on the baby boomer generation. So there's some of that thesis in the book, but he's definitely proud of that. I mean, that he identified with that character so much, it was his alter ego, that there's no way he couldn't be, almost.
Before we finish up with our chat today, the song I'm going to play in just a moment is the theme from Mannix. Can you tell us a little bit about the theme?
Well, Lalo Schifrin, who wrote the theme for Mission Impossible, wrote it. I don't know a whole lot about it. I've seen some people compare it to other works of jazz. It's a jazz waltz. I think that it was probably inspired by a computer panel, you know, the flashing lights that were the inspiration for the opening visual sequence of Mannix. But it's Lalo Schifrin has been quoted. I think it's the second most theme he's identified with, Mission Impossible being the first, but whenever he would go to concerts, he would play both of them.
Yeah. Joanne, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this. Fantastic TV show. If you haven't watched the show for a long time, do yourself a favor, grab the DVDs and watch it again. But most importantly, enjoy the book. And now back to Mannix. Joanne Paul, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
Who do you think is coming to town? You'll never guess who. Lovable, huggable, Emily Brown. Miss Brown to you. What if the she's coming to town. Just wait and you'll see the lovable, huggable little Miss Brown. She's baby to me. Thank you.
there.
The Cocktail Nation. Music for your bachelor pad.
Bird flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, a new day, a new life for me. Feeling good. Hey there, fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, a new day, a new life for me. Feeling good. I can fly out in the sun, you know what I mean. Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this whole world is a new world and a bold world for me. Shine, and you know how I feel. Scent of the pine, and you know how I feel. Freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, a new day, a new life for me. I feel good. I feel good. I feel good.
The Cocktail Nation with Bobby Darin and Feeling Good. Played that for a good friend of the Cocktail Nation, Darren, who sent that track to me just a little while ago. And I must say, far superior to the Michael Bublé version. Now, if you've got a retro kitchen, or maybe you're building a retro kitchen, perhaps following some of the advice of James M. Krause from last week's edition of the Cocktail Nation called A Kitchen of the Future, maybe you just need that one extra little thing, and that is the refrigerator. Now, it can be difficult to buy a vintage refrigerator that is in perfect working order. You can buy some reproduction ones, but they are very, very expensive. What to do? Well, I've got a very interesting story, which is over on our News from Across the Globe page of my website, cocktailnation.net, of these special sleeves that you can buy. It's through a website called retrorenovation.com, and basically it's the same sort of technology. Bring a sleeve, a cover, on your phone. We've all got those on our smartphones, kind of like a rubbery type sleeve. And this is what you can get in various pastel colours that you can put on your brand new fridge. And they only cost around about $100. It's the perfect way of finishing off your fridge. And certainly finishing off your kitchen and making it a whole lot more swank. RetroRenovation.com is the website. I've got the link on my website, CocktailNation.net, so check it out. Tony Mottola now, Going Out of My Head on the Cocktail Nation.
Thank you.
central Sydney. A man, a microphone, a dimly lit apartment, and a smoking jacket. The Cocktail Nation.
Cuba. All thanks to ultraswank.net, Project Pimento. You only live twice. The cool theremin sounds of Project Pimento. You might remember back in 2007, they pulled out a 1957 Plymouth Belvedere, known as Miss Belvedere. It was in a sealed concrete time capsule and was there for 50 years, a zero mileage car. Sadly, though, the way that they decided to preserve the car wasn't quite up to scratch, and the car didn't really make it out as well as they would have liked. It was somewhat rusty. In fact, so rusty that it was difficult to actually even transport the car. Now, they had a lot of hype around the retrieval of Miss Belvedere, as the car became known as. In 2007, pretty much every media outlet was there, and they speculated on the Belvedere's condition, whether it would start up on command after being pulled out of its sarcophagus. But sadly, it was fairly ordinary. So, to put a positive spin on the debacle, the Tulsa Historical Society displayed the car alongside of other relics from the time capsule in a temporary exhibit. Visitors came in respectable numbers to see the car in person. They had actually planned to pass the car on to the winner of the competition, who had to make a guess of what the actual population of Tulsa would be. Sadly, that person died. His name was Raymond Humbertson. He died in 1979. His wife had also died by then, so ownership of the car went to an older sister by the name of Catherine. But at age 93, her days of driving, or even taking physical possession of a rusted 1957 Plymouth, were well behind her. So they kept on trying to find somebody, and eventually her nephew Robert Carney and his sister M.C. Kesner were eventually the owners. So what to do with this marvelous car? Well, Robert Carney turned it over to Dwight Foster of Ultra One. It's a New Jersey manufacturer of rust-removing chemicals. It's claimed to be safe for services like paint beneath the oxidation. And in November of 2007, with the approval of the car's owners, the car was shrink-wrapped and shipped to Ultra One's warehouse, where it began the process of de-rusting and preservation. I must say they've done a pretty good job at it, but still, the car is somewhat in ordinary condition, despite removing a fair bit of the rust. And I must say, you can see it. I mean, you can see the colours have returned to the car. But the sad part of the story is that they don't know what to do with the car. Foster admits that he's put somewhere between $15,000 to $20,000 invested in Miss Belvedere's preservation. But he's equally clear that the car is still the property of Robert Carney and his sister. They said they'd like to see the car returned to Oklahoma for display. But sadly, there is little interest from the city of Tulsa, so that's unlikely to happen. They were hoping the Smithsonian would put it on display in their museum, but they're not willing to take possession of the car. So where is it going to be at the moment? Well, until Foster finds a museum or some other sympathetic caretaker willing to embrace Miss Belvedere, it's going to be sitting in the corner of his Ultra One warehouse, free from its watery tomb, but no less trapped in time and place. I hope eventually that car has a great home. It'd be nice to see it on display properly and probably restored too. That would be absolutely fantastic. But I guess it's all a case of money and motivation. Here's Stacey Kent now, The Face I Love on The Cocteau Nation.
Just think of things like daffodils and peaceful sheep on clovered hills, the morning song of whippoorwills, then you'll see the face that I love. Think of any old sky getting ready to cry. Down comes the rain, but it's raining confetti. Then think of things like far-off isles and blue-green eyes and sunlit smiles, and in your hand the wishing star, the one you thought too far above. Every love leaf you introduces you to the face I love. Just think of things like daffodils and peaceful sheep on clovered hills, the morning song of whippoorwills, and you'll see the face that I love. Think of any old sky getting ready to cry. Down comes the rain, but it's raining confetti. And think of things like far-off isles, blue-green eyes and sunlit smiles, and in your hand a wishing star, the one you thought too far above. Every love leaf you introduces you to the face I love. arms, and in your hand a wishing star, the one you thought too far above every lovely view, introduces you to the face I
Cocktonation for ultraswank.net. Lots of great stories online. Cocktonation.net. I've read out News of the World stories. And one story that I've got up there is an interesting one on what the 1964 World's Fair got right and what they got wrong. It's well worth a read. What's interesting, and probably not a surprise, is that the picture phone was one of the things that they did get right. If you've ever done a Skype call or a FaceTime call with your iPhone. Touch-tone phones, of course. Robotics were predicted and are well and truly in use across most of the globe. Probably not to the extent that they probably thought in 1964. But the interesting one was the personal use of the computer. And that's been, of course, a major technological advance for us here in the 21st century. So some interesting predictions there. I don't think anytime soon we will be seeing flying cars. And I don't think we're probably going to be seeing jetpacks. Whilst the jetpack has actually been invented, and I've been wanting one ever since I saw it on the Jetsons, I don't think that's going to be coming to fruition for the majority of people in the world. And certainly flying cars, well, let's face it, we can't get driving right. So let alone putting us into the sky, flying around cities and crashing to houses, I don't think that's likely to happen. Time for a look at the world of swank now for pastimealbumclocks.com. Tiki Con 2014, the Pacific Northwest Polynesian Pop Extravaganza returns July 11 at the Red Lion Hotel in Vancouver. Louis Prima and the Witnesses, Friday, June 6th, the official album release of their new album called Below. And you can see them. They are going to be in concert at The Mint in Los Angeles. Tikiaki 5-0 playing live in Palm Springs, 254 North Palm Canyon Drive in Palm Springs. This is coming up May the 10th, Tikiaki 5-0 at the Tonga Hut. And a regular at Forbidden Island, Otto's Grotto on a Thursday night. DJ Baz plays in Palm Springs Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. New Jazz and Latin Beats. This is over at 369 North Palm Canyon Drive in downtown Palm Springs. May 17, Alika Lyman Group playing at Tiki Caliente, along with the Martini Kings, tikicaliente.com, and lots of other bands, of course. Final Hooky Lau coming up June 11. You can see the Martini Kings from Los Angeles at the Tonga Hut in Palm Springs. They've got lots of regular gigs, which we've got up on the website, cocktonation.net. May 25, it's the Luau, Forbidden Island, Lincoln Avenue, Alameda. Pig Roast, Hula and Fire Dancers, Hot Steel and Cool Ukulele, and the Fishermen are playing there as well. These gigs, many, many more, you can find them all online, cocktailnation.net. I regularly update the World of Swank gig guide, so you can always find something that is on for you to check out. Jack Marshall now with Clouds on the Cocktail Nation.
Thank you. How's it going? This is Ricky Derrick.
Aloha. This is Andy Nazelle of Tiki Joe's Ocean.
From Waikiki Beach, this is Philip Roberts, the author of Waikiki Tiki, Art, History, and Photographs.
Hi, this is Tommy Tremolo from Spy 5.
Hey, everybody. This is Marty Lush, and when I'm drinking, which is often, I'm listening to Cocktail Nation.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
She is walking quickly, like there's some place she must be. In her eyes, there's no one. There is no one she needs. He sits with his paper at a Sunday table, just another. At him. For a moment there is nowhere she is going. He looks at her. She looks at him. For a moment they could almost fall in love. Not a
Cocktonation with Lounge Leader Coop Cooper and Bing Martini with Sunday Table. Next week we are back in the Comedy Lounge with some more classic comedy coming your way. And certainly throughout the week I would love to hear from you too. If there's something that you like played on the show, maybe an idea that you might like to suggest as a segment or perhaps a special. Roman got in contact with me and made a fine suggestion of a show, which I won't reveal yet, but we'll bring that to you a little bit later on. Maybe you'd just like to shoot me an email. Love to hear from you. You can email thecocktonation@gmail.com. In the Contact Us page of the website, cocktonation.net, you can certainly get in contact with us via various social media as well. We've got the links up there for you. I'm going to leave you now with New Gary Burton Quartet and Did You Get It? Stay here.